Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
What were ancient roofs built from?
And have ants ever ruined an archaeological dig?
I'm answering your questions on today's Time Team podcast.
Yes, hello and welcome to the Time Team podcast. Helen Geek and Martin Williams here. We had a debate before we started recording the podcast as to how you were going to say the word, roofs or roofs? And I don't think we got an answer, did we?
I think because you spell it roofs, you say roofs. I don't know.
I just definitely say roofs.
Do you?
It's probably wrong though. It's probably wrong.
Hoof and hooves, but also grooves and groove. Oh, English, what a language.
I know. We're in danger of going down that road again, aren't we? And we're not, because we're doing an archaeology podcast.
I know, the trouble is that the two of us so love the history of language, but I'm sure we'll stray into it. We can never avoid it.
No, well, we can't. Well, it's people, isn't it? People speak languages, and archaeology is the study of people in ancient times. So it all ties together very nicely. This podcast is all about you, especially if you're a Time Team member, and especially if you've asked a question. And you can do that right now, by the way, for future editions of these sorts of podcasts. If you go to the chat section on Patreon, if you're a Time Team member, you'll be able to see the place there to ask your question. Loads of people have done that, and I've picked out just 4 to include on the podcast this week. There's also another edition of Helen's Find coming up as well, which is where Helen is going to bring an interesting object to your attention that tells a story of the past. So we're going to get to that in just a moment. But should we dive in with question number 1? And it comes from Riggs. And Riggs says, during archaeological work, the further you go down, the further back in time you travel. Okay, so far so good. This implies that the Earth just gets bigger and bigger each year. As this is not the case, are there any situations where going down does not in fact go further back in time, or situations where all the archaeology is in the same layer? I don't know, by the way, Riggs, that you necessarily are wrong in saying that the Earth gets bigger and bigger each year, because we get hit by comets all the time and meteors, don't we, that add to the amount of stuff on the Earth. Not by a huge amount, but I don't know. There's probably some sciencey answer to whether the Earth is actually getting bigger and bigger. But maybe let's leave that to one side and just talk about the archaeology, Helen, shall we?
Well, actually, I think we've had a question before that says, why is the Earth getting bigger and bigger? And if not, why does archaeology keep getting buried? And the answer to that is because we lose bits in some places and we gain bits in others. So the tops wear off mountains and come down to the lower parts, water, erosion, rain, wind, all sorts of things. That's the quick answer to that. But as Riggs says, the Earth doesn't get bigger and bigger each year by any amount that we can measure. So I think, Martin, for every comet bit of debris and every meteorite, there's probably some kind of explosion that shoots off, vaporizes something that we lose.
Yeah.
Are there any situations where going down does not in fact go further back in time? Well, yes, there can be a kind of upended stratigraphy. So I always think that stratigraphy, the best way to think about this is like a layer cake. So if you make your cake with lots of layers of icing and different sponge layers, and then a good thick layer of icing on the top like turf, you can have an accident, like when somebody digs out a bit with a spoon and turns some of it over. So sometimes our layers can be not exactly where they were put in the first place or how they've developed in the first place, but they can be disturbed. But we like to dig sites that are deeply stratified So they've got lots of layers, lots of different layers that are all in the right order, because that way we've got all the information that we could possibly get out of them. So if you are going down and you find that your layers are in the wrong order, that tells you something interesting as well. But if you go down and you aren't going further back in time, well, you're clearly not going further forward in time. So essentially, you just stop. And I think if you're just stopping, if there's no more further back in time, then you've hit the natural subsoil or the bedrock. So in a sense, if you were digging and you found that, you would just stop and you would probably wish that you hadn't started there in the first place. Now, there are exceptions. So if you're trying to excavate to find how big a site is, this is often done with Anglo-Saxon cemeteries, you want to find the edge. There's very rarely a clear boundary, so a ditch or fence line or something like that. You just need to excavate a large area with no graves to prove that you've got to the edge. So at that point, there's a lot of excavation of something where you're not going further back in time. You're just proving that there's nothing old there. So the other option, situations where all the archaeology is in the same layer, well, we're going to have lost a lot of information at that stage. It tends to be where the layers have been scrambled by ploughing or by animal burrows, or maybe for really deep prehistory, they've been all ground together by glaciation. And that damage means that we can't get so much information out. So if you've got the choice, and through remote sensing, perhaps you can work out if you've got deep stratigraphy or not. I mean, that's the kind of thing that radar is absolutely brilliant for. You would choose to go somewhere where the stratigraphy is really excellent, deep, in the right order, full of datable finds. If you can choose, you'd go for that. So the answer, I suppose, is that there are situations where you don't go further back or in time, but you try to minimise your contact with them. Does that answer the question, do you think, Martin?
I think it does. What I wanted to add was something that I have discovered as I've been around archaeologists and watching the archaeology process that I suppose I didn't really think about before. I think that when I thought about archaeologists discovering, let's say, a Roman villa, in my mind, it was sort of like you dig and the first thing you get to is the roof of the building, and then you dig a little bit more and then you get the walls and oh, that's where the door would have been. And finally, if you get down far enough, you've got the whole building fully standing, completely buried. But that isn't really, in general, what happens. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here, but there's a whole process before that whereby that villa, that building, whatever it is, maybe would fall into disrepair through no use of it, for example. The roof would fall off, the walls would fall down, maybe some people come along, they take away the building materials to use for other things, and what you're left with is a pretty much ground level, just the foundations, which get covered by a little bit of soil, rather than what was in my head, which was that meters and meters and meters of soil have been piled on top of this building and it's all there in the ground ready for archaeologists to find. It sounds stupid when I say it out loud, but I think in my head that's what I thought it was until I saw it happening in real life.
Yes, and that's so interesting because from the age of six, I lived in Bath. And so I was really used to the Roman baths. We went there all the time. And you knew that you had to go downstairs. You'd stand at the Great Bath and you'd see Bath Abbey miles above you. My imagination was that everything sank into the marsh, really, because of all the bubbling hot water and all the kind of gooey squelchiness that there is around Bath. My view was that it slowly sank while bits were being chipped off the top. So your experiences of what you feel is normal as a child, that's what you're trying to use as your template. And we all have such different experiences, don't we? So I think that somebody, I remember talking to somebody who lived in an old school, an old primary school, and part of his garden was the playground. And it was a tarmac playground where they parked the cars, and it was overshadowed by trees. Every year they had to shovel off leaf mould and soil. And he said, people wonder how archaeological sites get buried. Why don't they just come round to my house and have a look? Yeah. So it's all our personal experiences that go towards understanding in this way.
Really, really good question, Riggs. Thank you very much for it. Helen's find in a moment, but first, here's Rebecca Fitchett, who has this question. Rebecca's asking you, Helen, if you can talk a little bit more about the intersection of various different disciplines, archaeology, anthropology, geology. These three disciplines, says Rebecca, often overlap when looking at sites, landscapes, and evidence from the Holocene, Anthropocene. Have I said that right? I think so.
I think so.
I would love to hear Helen's thoughts. Well, firstly, what are the Holocene and Anthropocene?
They're not terms that I use terribly much working in largely historic periods, but the Holocene is the geological era that we're living in at the moment. And the Anthropocene is the one that we that has been suggested for the kind of 19th, 20th, 21st centuries, because we're now affecting the world so much with climate change and with the production of fossil fuels and plastics that we may be coming into a different geological era, which would logically, well, you can either call it the Anthropocene, or if you're feeling facetious, you could call it the Plasticine, because it is characterized by the plastics. But that yeah. word has already been taken, Plasticine.
I was going to say, Plasticine is something else.
Yes, yes. So, incidentally, Plasticine, did you know it was invented in Bath?
No.
Not many people know that. No, the Plasticine Factory. Yeah, oh. Very absolutely.
Good. What about Play-Doh? Where was that invented?
Oh, Play-Doh. Oh, you can make your own Play-Doh. You don't need anybody to invent that. Yeah. Well, I'm wondering if Rebecca is asking this question from America, because British archaeology is almost uniquely disadvantaged in that we don't tend to combine with other disciplines. We do teach anthropology alongside archaeology in some universities. Cambridge is the most famous for this approach. It's a really good approach, but it's just not traditional outside Cambridge, really. And I think that's a pity, because the more that we understand about anthropology, about how societies work across the world, the easier we might find it to understand the past, or at least understand what the possibilities are. It opens our eyes a bit. And the more we know about geology, the more we can understand what's underlying the landscape in a kind of natural way, and distinguish that from what humans have done to it. So Mick Aston, he studied geology, and he was always saying that every archaeologist should have a smattering of geology. But in fact, we don't have many archaeologists with that kind of background, and we're not even encouraged to read the basic textbooks, which I think is a problem. But I think the reason why British archaeology tends to avoid those interdisciplinary approaches is that as archaeologists, we guard our boundaries incredibly jealously. We even have this old song, "Only Archaeology Can Reveal the Truth," sung to the tune of Onward Christian Soldiers.
Really?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. There's this kind of prejudice against, with anthropology, we used to call it the ethnographic parallel. So that can be kind of exaggerated for effect, that the ethnographic parallel is essentially somebody saying, well, they do it like this in Papua New Guinea, so it's probable that they did it like this in Neolithic Yorkshire. I mean, that is really simplistic, and that's really completely misunderstanding what an anthropologist does to mesh their work with archaeology. So there's that prejudice against the simple ethnographic parallel, and that may be partly British archaeology rejecting views that came in from colonial era people. So if you had lived for a long time in the colonies, come back to Britain, do a bit of archaeology, you may bring this kind of knowledge and experience that you simplistically apply to British archaeology that isn't appropriate. So that's, I think, where that prejudice has arisen from. There's also another prejudice against what you might call environmental determinism, and this is where geology comes in. So if you say something like, this kind of house is built here because of the geology here, and that kind of house is built there because of the geology there that's different, that was not thought to be a sophisticated enough explanation, because there's no room there for the human in that. There's no room for creativity, for artistry, for politics, for any of the things that we think make the study of the past interesting. So environmental determinism was really, really frowned upon. But things are beginning to change, because it shouldn't mean that the environment has no effect on the way we live. And these days we realise that, of course, now we're going through environmental change. Now we've got climate breakdown. It's already having a huge effect on the way we live our lives. So that's a form of environmental determinism, saying that we have to live in a different way because we have more storms or more rainfall or less rainfall or sea level rise, whatever it is. We're beginning to realise that the environment does play a part, and it's not the black and white of environmental determinism on the one hand and totally human decisions on the other. They work in sync. So I think British archaeology has said, no, it's too simplistic. Take it away. We don't like anthropology, we don't like ethnographic parallels, we don't like geology because we don't like environmental determinism, and we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. We really ought to bring both of these things back.
And just the more information that you have to add to a site, the better you understand it as well, surely?
Yes, absolutely. And the people who do use geology all the time are the deep prehistorians. You can't do anything without understanding geology if you want to look at the really deep past, because geology has transformed the sites. You can't just look at the site and say, well, this has not changed a great deal in the last 2,000 years. If you've got 200,000 years, the whole landscape has changed, and you have to understand everything about geological processes to understand how your site has come to be there, how it's come to be preserved, and what it looked like originally.
Interesting stuff. Rebecca, thank you very much indeed. Should we do Helen's find now? I think we could do that. We could park the questions for just a little bit. We'll come back to them. Got a couple more for you in just a moment. But first, yeah, Helen's find. This is the bit of the podcast where Helen chooses an object from history. And I will put links to this object, by the way, in the description of this podcast, so you go and look at it for yourself. But it's an object from history that maybe tells a bit of a story. So what have you chosen this time?
Well, this week I have decided to look at quite an ordinary looking object, because I think I've looked at some quite remarkable things recently, and I wanted to have something that didn't immediately knock your eye out with beautiful glitz and glamour.
I think this item, though, I'm just looking at it, I think it could have your eye out. It looks quite sharp and pointy.
It could literally, that's absolutely true. It was found in Herefordshire, and so it's recorded on the Portable Antiquities Scheme database. It's made from copper alloy, and in fact, it looks like a pin. So absolutely, it is the kind of thing that could be quite dangerous. So it's got a round section shaft with one end pointed, and the other end is expanded into this flat triangular terminal. But if you look carefully, and you can see that Peter, who recorded it, has added a little oblique photograph that shows it really well. It's got two little dot eyes, which show you that there's a subtle hint at an animal head at the junction of the terminal and the pin shaft, or the pin head and the pin shaft, you might call it if it was a pin. So the animal's kind of gripping the shaft in its mouth. And this object is in fact probably not just a pin. You could have used it as a pin, but it's probably, and it has been recorded as, a stylus. And that's a writing implement. Now, as writing becomes more and more common in the Anglo-Saxon world from kind of the 8th century onwards, really, there's suddenly an upsurge in the number of these objects. They're identified as styli because, well, partly because they have this point which could be used to scratch letters in wax. Now, a thin layer of wax, beeswax, this would be, was added to wooden or bone tablets, little square tablets with recesses for the wax. And you could make notes in the wax with these points, and the object itself fits quite nicely in the hand. It's thinner in diameter than a pencil, but it's about the same size otherwise. So when the point scratches through the wax, sometimes it, by mistake, marked the tablet itself. And so sometimes where these wooden or bone tablets survive, you can see the writing scratched lightly on the bone or the wood. But that's very rare. And the writing is normally supposed to be in the wax. And you are supposed to reuse the surface by smoothing it over with the flat triangular end, with that eraser end, as it's known. So it looks absolutely perfect for use as a stylus. And also, we are fairly confident in this identification because they've very often been found at excavated monastery sites. And in fact, this one was also found near a known monastery. There have been a few arguments about why they seem to be more often found in metal rather than they could have been made of bone, maybe, or antler, something like that. People say, why are they made in metal? Well, I'm not sure that we really know that they were more often found in metal. It's just that metal detectorists can find them, and so we can record them. Because I've actually done a couple of experiments, because we keep bees, so we have beeswax handy for experiments. And in fact, if you scratch into wax with a bone point, it works absolutely fine. And you can smooth over again with bone. You can do it mechanically. The idea was that the metal ones could be heated up. You heat up the eraser end and you draw it across the wax to erase what you wrote. Well, you can do that, but you don't have to. You can do everything fine with a bit of bone. These styli, I just find them, you know how... Yes, back to our love of language, Martin. You know how the writing is so seductive to an archaeologist who doesn't deal with writing. And these are the first things that we can see that have survived. They're not quill pens or anything like that. They're the first things that we can see in the Anglo-Saxon period that have been used to write. And they last in use beyond the Norman Conquest, right into the High Medieval period.
It's a really beautiful object as well. Simple, but beautifully made. And if you want to go and see it, I put a link to that object, Helen's Find, in the description of the podcast.
This is the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. And I just wanted to read this comment from Stephen Parks. He says, any chance you could wish the Bristol and Gloucestershire Archaeological Society a happy 150th birthday?
Our hey, county societies, happy birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday. Happy birthday. And Stephen says, our county societies are a great way to get involved in archaeology. Absolutely. And I'm so pleased to know that the Bristol and Gloucestershire Archaeological Society is 150 years old this year, because I'm actually an ex-member.
Oh, really? Oh, great. Even better.
Yeah, as I said earlier on, I grew up in Bath. And when I first decided I wanted to be an archaeologist, I went off and joined my local learned society, which was Bristol and Gloucestershire, or Bristol and Avon, as it was then. I went to the talks. I discovered what it was like to go to a proper learned talk at a proper learned society. The most memorable one is I heard Leslie Grinsell talk about barrows. Now, you won't have heard of Leslie Grinsell, Martin,
no,
I don't think. Oddly, he's been quite forgotten. He was a remarkable man who was largely self-taught, picked this topic of prehistoric barrows as something where he could make a contribution. But extraordinarily, he never learnt to drive. So he visited virtually every single barrow across England, and probably most of the Welsh ones as well, by bus, train, on foot. He was a great walker, and by bicycle. And he was also interested in their folklore. So he was really good at seeing how they had been understood in the years after they were built, in the medieval and the modern world. So he's been slightly forgotten. But Bristol and Gloucestershire Archaeological Society provided me with talks like that, that made me realise how big the world of archaeology was, what it could encompass. And I was probably a member for a year before things like that helped me get into university, and then my career was set, really. So thank you, Bristol and Gloucestershire Archaeological Society, and happy birthday.
Yes, thank you very much indeed, and happy birthday. There you go. You didn't know, did you, Stephen, that there was a bit of Helen Geek history in those 150 years. Okay, let's move on to question number three, isn't it? And it comes from Erin, who's got in touch as a Time Team member over on Patreon, who says, how are roofing materials determined for non-tile or stone roof houses? Thatch is often shown in recreations, but what is found in the ground to indicate that? So if it isn't stone and if it isn't tile, which you would know because you'd be able to find it, how do you know what it would have been?
Well, you really have to go through a process of elimination. So you can rule out the tiles, whether they're pottery, slate, stone, whatever. Then you have to look at what next is the most likely that doesn't conflict with your negative evidence. So thatch, well, it's pretty easy to thatch a roof. It may not be easy now with all the wonderful technology of thatching, but in the past it would have been reasonably easy to do in a rudimentary way. And we're also very familiar with thatch because we have it now. So it tends to be something that we suggest because it's immediately at the front of our minds, I think. But there are other options.
My friend from Australia came to visit me here in the Midlands not too long ago, and I said, oh, I'll take you around Warwickshire, you know, we'll go and see some of the... She said, can we go and see one of those hairy houses? I said, What are you talking about? You know they're houses, but that, you know, they're hairy. So now whenever I see a thatched cottage or something, I go, oh, look, a hairy house.
That's fantastic. Yes, I suppose there's not much thatch in Australia.
No,
you just
I guess
go
not.
With what's familiar. Yeah, but there are other options, and I would love to see a turf roof, a totally turf roof in situ, because maybe that would look equally hairy. I don't really know. Turf roofs are found at Must Farm, you know, the Bronze Age village where it was built over a fen. It caught fire and collapsed in, so it's so well preserved because it's partly burnt and partly waterlogged. But I've seen from Must Farm that they've also suggested that roofs are made of clay, because Must Farm is in a clayey area. It wouldn't have been impossible to get that, and it was actually found during clay quarrying. But can you make a roof out of clay? Wouldn't that be really difficult? Wouldn't it be really heavy?
I don't know. Very heavy.
Yeah, that's one that I think I'm going to have to look at a bit more closely. But there is one other option that people often suggest, because you can still see it occasionally today, and that's wooden tiles. They're known as shingles. Now, shingles are not easy to make. You have to prepare... Well, first of all, you have to find a very straight-grained piece of timber. Then you have to cleave it into very thin boards, and then you cut them up for the shingles. But then how do you fix them on? You know, with a clay tile, you can do it with wooden pegs. That doesn't work for shingles. You need lots of little nails. So it's really difficult and it's really expensive. But apart from the nails, they don't leave much trace. So the question we then get, Martin, is how early might shingles have started to be used? And the piece of evidence I'm going to use for this is going to make you sit up and listen, because it's etymology. One of the ways that you can think when did people have the concept of shingles is by looking at the etymology of the word. Now, obviously, it's got several meanings. Shingles the disease, shingle on the beach. But the one that means a thin piece of wood used for roofing is Old English. So they were using that word to mean a thin piece of wood used for roofing in the late Old English period, and it's borrowed from a Latin word. Incidentally, it is also used apparently to mean a thin piece of wood that you used for a wax writing tablet. So you could write with your stylus on a shingle, just as we were talking about earlier. But the take-home message from this is that if the word existed in the late Anglo-Saxon period, shingles could have been used on roofs from then. So they could be that old. Doesn't prove that they were, but they could have been. But that need for nails means that they probably weren't used in prehistory. So if we're dealing with a prehistoric reconstruction, we need to put something... I'm afraid I'm going to continue to use this term. We're going to have something hairy. It's either going to be thatch or it's going to be turf. And presumably turf continues to grow and is deeply hairy. If we're looking at something Roman or later, we can use wooden shingles if we want to. If we've got something like an awful lot of iron nails, which means that we've got enough evidence for shingles, we can use them from the Roman period onwards. Otherwise, it's thatch or turf.
This question is not too dissimilar from one we had, which basically changed the face of all questions. Do you remember we had a question about whether there are stairs or not in Roman buildings? And the fact is that we don't actually know. And nobody's got evidence as to whether or not there were ever stairs, or what those, if there were stairs, what they were made out of or anything like that. And it was one of those questions that sort of blew our minds. This could be a similar one. Does anybody really know what was on the roofs of houses that weren't tile and stone and things, and slate and things like that, things that you can't find evidence of, and you just got to do a bit of guesswork, really.
Yes, or have those questions in your mind. So with the turf roof, I know that you can find evidence for turf walls. As they rot, the little tiny stones, you get more of the little tiny stones along the lines of a turf wall. Is there an archaeological signature for the remains of a turf roof when it decays and slides off? I don't know. It may be that because the roof moves during decay, it may be that we can never find out. But it's a question really for somebody like Naomi. It's going to be an environmental question. I don't quite know what the question is, but somebody like Naomi could probably formulate it.
I'll draft an email right away. I shall say, dear Naomi, do you know if there were hairy houses?
That's it. Do you know how we would find out if there were
hairy houses? If there were hairy houses,
absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Okay, good question. Let's have the final one, which I think is quite a fun one. This comes in from Dee, who says, has a dig ever been a major pain due to ants? Okay, I can only imagine the nightmare of digging into a trench only to discover it's a major ant hive, etc. Gross, says Dee, having to just sit there while a billion ants go crazy around and on you. I mean, it does sound like a nightmare. It would be my worst nightmare. That would be horrible. Have there ever been times where the creepy crawlies have just made digging impossible?
I have never heard of one. And out of all of the awful stories that archaeologists tell in the pub, you might think that if they were a problem, we would have heard about it. And I think that the reason that it's not a problem, certainly in the UK, is that our ants live in the topsoil, very high up in most cases. Even if all you're doing is stripping off the turf, most of an ant's nest will come away with that. And certainly if you're doing topsoil stripping with a machine, that will certainly get rid of all the ants. Now, I know that there are, if you look up how deep does an ant's nest go, and I have done this in the past because I've been interested in those ant hills that you get in very, very ancient pasture land. I think it's the yellow meadow ant or something that produces these hills. And they go down deep as well. But a live one is going to be visible on the surface because it's got the ant hill sticking up. So most ants' nests will come away in the topsoil. Also, the ants' nest won't disturb the archaeology because it's already disturbed the ground, if you see what I mean. You can easily remove it without further damage to the archaeology. It's not something that, well, I suppose in a way it is. It's a bit like a badger burrow. They'll have disturbed the archaeology where they are, but not around the outside. So taking it out ought not to be a problem. And anyway, UK ants don't really bite very much. I'm thinking really more.
I'll just give you a little nip, just a little nip.
Well, yeah, but imagine being a buildings archaeologist who encounters a wasp's nest.
Oh, no,
yeah.
Thank you.
I can imagine that you might have to, if it's a job that you've been commissioned to do in a house that's maybe going to be demolished or taken down and rebuilt somewhere else, like in a museum, you might even have to call in the pest controller and get rid of the wasp's nest. Sad though that would be.
Oh, it wouldn't be sad. It wouldn't be sad. I'm sorry. I just, wasps for me are just the worst. When people always say
that
to you, yeah, I do. I have a real issue with them. People say, oh, just stay still. They won't. I cannot physically stay still. I have to run away. It's the
yes,
only thing I
know.
I'm
like that with spiders and crane flies, all sorts of things like that. It isn't rational. I know that these phobias are probably a really deep evolutionary thing. There's a reason for some people to be phobic, and I certainly am about spiders. So I sympathise with you. Yes, perhaps a career as a buildings archaeologist may be...
Not the one for me.
Yeah. Would be
not
difficult
the one
because
for
of
me.
Wasps.
No. Some really, really good questions there. So thank you very much for them. I'm just thinking about, we're off to, Time Team's off to the Ness of Brodgar in a few months' time, going to Orkney. Now, is that part of Scotland known for the old midges?
I'm not sure.
Is that going to be an issue?
I think that you've got so much wind in Orkney that you don't need to worry about the midges. I am actually going on holiday this year to the west coast of Scotland, and I'm going to take my midge hood, which is a black net bag.
You're going to put a bag over your head?
Okay. Yes, okay. I'm afraid so.
Okay. Well, if you happen to be in the west coast of Scotland this summer and you see somebody walking around with a bag on their head, it could be Helen Geek. So make sure you say hello. Very good. Well, that's been a fun podcast, I think. And I've been doing a lot of laughing in that, and I hope you have as well. Thank you very much for your questions. If you want to submit yours, you can join us and become a Time Team member. You get all sorts of perks, by the way, from access to ad-free and bonus podcasts to masterclasses we do. There's 3D models. Honestly, there's so much more. And you're supporting the archaeology that we carry out as Time Team. You go to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for more information.
Next week, we're going to be demonstrating some of those 3D models Martin just mentioned with our 3D graphics whiz, Bear. Plus, we're following the team as they scope out a new site, which could be somewhere we excavate in the future.
You're going to be able to watch that episode on YouTube or, of course, listen wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're a Time Team member, you do get everything we do completely ad-free. We'll catch you again next week for another edition of the Time Team podcast. Thanks for listening.
Bye.